Will your church be one of the issues, etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues, etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues, etc. 300, click the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues, etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues, etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Well, books like this tend to sell, and from what I hear, it's a real page-turner, like the two previous novels by Dan Brown. Angels and Demons was a previous one, and before that, of course, Who Could Forget the Da Vinci Code? The Lost Symbol is the latest book by Dan Brown, and this one deals with the Masonic Lodge and how the secrets of the Masonic Lodge and the secrets of the American Foundation and all of these things are tied up together. How all world religions really, in fact, end up being kind of the same thing, according to Dan Brown. We're going to review this book. Dr. Alvin Schmidt joins us to do just that. He's an expert on the Masonic Lodge. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of Fraternal Organizations and co-author of the Encyclopedic Dictionary of Cults, Sects, and World Religions. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Two quick first questions before we actually hear some of the novel itself and get your reaction to it. The theology that Dan Brown seems to have formed over his fictional career is that all world religions are essentially the same and can be reconciled with one another. Is that congruent with the so-called theology of the Masonic Lodge?
Yes, very much so. In fact, I don't know whether he learned it in part from the Masonic Lodge or whether he just learned it from our culture of relativism. It could be some of both. You know, back in August, Newsweek magazine this year had an article, a very interesting one, that says we are all Hindus now, talking about the American population, including most Christians, which is another similar theme, and Hinduism basically teaches it. One of its main doctrines is that all religions lead to eternal life. And this is pretty much what Dan Brown is talking about, and that is, of course, definitely what Freemasonry talks about. When a Mason dies and he has a Masonic funeral, they don't all necessarily have one, but when they do, part of the Masonic ritual at the funeral says that he will now live in the celestial lodge above. And he attains that basically by being a good Mason or a good upright individual. The salvation by Jesus Christ is conspicuously omitted and always missing. And so all religions, again, and this is why Freemasonry, for example, will take any particular religious person. All he has to do is believe in a God, which in English-speaking masonry is often referred to as the grand architect, and hence you find the letter G in the compass and square symbol often displayed in American masonry. It's not that way in the continental part of Europe, but it is in English-speaking masonry. And again, that great architect is, or grand architect as it's sometimes also referred to, is someone who is not defined. He is someone whomever, or however you understand him, however you think he is. And that is basically very much a core of Freemasonry teaching. And Dan Brown very much seems to echo that in different ways in his novel.
So does Dan Brown paint an accurate picture of Freemasonry in the novel The Lost Symbol?
Well, in most cases he does. He does take liberties here and there, as he does with a lot of things. In fact, he even sometimes, at least in one place, seems to sort of try to protect Freemasonry, if I may use that word, because the Masons like to say that their ritual is secret. They're not a secret society, but a society with secrets, is how they often put it. Well, yet I have discovered over my 40-some years of studying fraternal organization and most prominently Freemasonry, there is nothing secret. Many years ago, I read something from an ex-Mason. He said, anything you want to learn about Freemasonry is available, is in print. The only trouble is you have to do some looking and some digging to find it. And that's very, very true. I have dozens of books and pamphlets and my files corroborating what Masonry does. And when you talk to a Mason, he was an honest individual, no one else is around, he will admit it. They've admitted it to me more than once. And so, for example, one of the things that they publicly say is that the ritual, when an individual exposes it, it is a clandestine religion, and clandestine ritual, and not to be seen as authentic. And Dan Brown, in one place of his novel, refers to this kind of thing, where he refers to the ritual and says, well, this is going to make the critics excited about what goes on at a Masonic lodge, in essence saying, well, this is really not what goes on as the as he exposes part of the ritual, but that's really not part of it. He's implying that. So in a sense, he's covering, well, throughout the whole book is really in many ways a subtle way of promoting Freemasonry, and he does this in a number of ways.
Well, we have some excerpts from the novel, The Lost Symbol, for you to react to and explain to us, Dr. Schmidt. The first is, Dan Brown calls the novel kind of a travelogue of Washington, D.C., our capital city, and he makes much of the U.S. Capitol and its Masonic symbols.
It was no secret that D.C. had a rich Masonic history. The cornerstone of this very building had been laid in a full Masonic ritual by George Washington himself. This city had been conceived and designed by master Masons, George Washington, Ben Franklin, and Pierre L'Enfant, powerful minds who adorned their new capital with Masonic symbolism, architecture, and art. Of course, people see in those symbols all kinds of crazy ideas. Many conspiracy theorists claimed the Masonic forefathers had concealed powerful secrets throughout Washington, along with symbolic messages hidden in the city's layout of streets. Langdon never paid any attention. Misinformation about the Masons was so commonplace that even educated Harvard students seemed to have surprisingly warped conceptions about the Brotherhood.
An excerpt from the audio CD of Dan Brown's newest novel, The Lost Symbol. Your reaction, Dr. Schmidt?
Yeah, it was interesting. Again, in those few lines that you heard quoted, again, he's mixing fact and fiction. And yes, indeed, George Washington was a Mason. In fact, when the Capitol, the cornerstone was laid, he wore Masonic regalia. Ben Franklin was a Mason. Pierre L'Enfant, as far as I can determine, was not a Mason. But in this particular paragraph, he is called one. And then he talks about Masonic symbolism in architecture and art. Yes, there is some of that. There's no doubt about that. And in that sense, he is correct. There is some misinformation in terms of Masonic influences. For example, some of Masonic or some individuals, critics and the like, tend to think that the streets are even laid out in an inverted pentagram and the like. Well, I have looked at that a long time, and I'm not convinced that that's really accurate. And I'm not convinced that Pierre L'Enfant, who was one of the main architects in terms of designing the city of Washington, D.C., first of all, as far as I can determine, he was not a Mason, and that was not part of his thinking either. So a little bit of truth, a little bit of fiction.
So when we have when we see these Masonic symbols, someone says, well, I've been to D.C. and I've seen the stuff that's in Dan Brown's novel, and I've seen this stuff. Should they immediately jump to the conclusion, all the founders were Masons and they were out there creating a symbolic Masonic utopia? About 30 seconds here.
Yes, that's a good question. No, many forefathers of our country were Masons. By no means all of them. In fact, I can't even say the majority of them were. For example, even in his book, he mentions that the majority of the signers of the Constitution of our country were Masons. Well, it's simply not true. There were 39 people who signed it. Only 14 of them were Masons. And so, again, fact and fiction on the part of Brown is surfacing again.
Well, here's that very assertion from the novel The Lost Symbol by Dan Brown.
What would you say if I told you the city of Washington, D.C. has more astrological signs in its architecture than any other city in the world? Zodiacs, star charts, cornerstones laid at precise astrological dates and times. More than half of the framers of our Constitution were Masons, men who strongly believed that the stars and fate were intertwined, men who paid close attention to the layout of the heavens as they structured their new world.
Again, your reaction to this assertion in Dan Brown's novel. He seems to be, it's fiction, but he seems to be saying this is how you understand what's going on in Washington, D.C. architecturally?
Well, there are a lot of astrological signs in its architecture, whether more than any other city, that I'm not so sure of. I mean, I really don't know. I'd have to go to Paris, I'd have to go to Rome and other places like that and determine that. More than half of the founding fathers, I just mentioned a little while ago, simply is not true. Whether they all believed in the stars and the faith of, and connected with them, intertwined with the faith of men, again, who knows? Some of them may have. You know, Benjamin Franklin was somewhat of a mystic. George Washington, as far as I can tell, was not, although both of them were Freemasons. So it's very, very difficult to say. And what's also interesting, these individuals don't or didn't often reveal their real thinking, if they had it. And so Brown is, in a sense, assuming perhaps more than necessary. And there were others besides Ben Franklin who were somewhat mystically inclined. And Ben Franklin perhaps more so than many others. And if you look at a person like John Hancock, a noted Mason, for example, again, mysticism, I can't really find it in his writings.
When we come back, Dan Brown asserts that there's a big Masonic secret at the heart of the American founding and American history. We'll hear the assertion from the novel, The Lost Symbol, and we'll get reaction from our guest in this hour, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of Fraternal Organizations, and co-author of the Encyclopedic Dictionary of Cults, Sects, and World Religions, an authority on Freemasonry. Our call-in number on this Thursday, the 15th of October, 1-877-623-6943. 1-877-623-MY-I-E. You can email questions or comments to us right here in the studio. We get them in real time. Talkback at issuesetc.org. Talkback at issuesetc.org. Or Twitter us at issuesetc. So what's the big secret? What's the big Masonic secret? We'll find out on the other side of the break.
Sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Pro-life youth take action for the unborn.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Lila Rose is a 20-year-old attending school at UCLA, but her days are not like those of your typical college student. While she attends classes like everyone else, she spends much of her free time going undercover. Sound like she works for the CIA? She doesn't. Lila Rose works with a group called Live Action, which uses new media and educational presentations to celebrate life and expose threats posed against the vulnerable and defenseless. Tune in next time to see how this group of young pro-lifers is taking on America's largest abortion business.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
Moloch gazed at the window, which displayed part of the church's doctrinal statement. We believe that Jesus Christ was begotten by the Holy Spirit and born of the Virgin Mary, and is both true man and God. Moloch smiled. Yes, Jesus is indeed both. man and God. But a virgin birth is not the prerequisite for divinity. That is not how it happens.
That's an excerpt from The Lost Symbol, Dan Brown's latest best-selling novel about Freemasonry, about American history, and he's got a big religious point to make, too, as he does in all of his novels. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. Dr. Schmidt, what religious point is Dan Brown trying to make when he introduces Jesus into the mix of his kind of Masonic interpretation of American history?
Well, I think a couple of things. For one, he is critical of Christianity in that statement that we just heard from one of the main characters in the book, Moloch, by the way, who was a 33rd degree Mason, according to the novel. He was not a good Mason. He was in pursuit of the lost symbol, and as a result, became very sinister and deviant and even killed individuals to try and find it. But the point that he's making here by this, by quoting Moloch relative to the virgin birth not being necessary is, again, a subtle, maybe not so subtle, criticism of Christianity or those Christians who believe that Christ was born of the Virgin Mary. In other words, Christianity is really, and implying they're not really that much different than other religions, unless you believe in those kind of miracles like the virgin birth. And, of course, in Brown's opinion, that's not true.
So in the course of this story, it sounds like he is very, at first subtly and then later in the novel, overtly trying to make a case not just about America and Freemasonry, but a statement about Christianity itself.
Oh, very definitely. That he does that in a number of different places. He takes a swipe, if you might say, at Christianity. And this is just one of the examples. Even toward the end of the book, for example, he begins to do that by quoting from John's gospel, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. And, of course, in pursuit of, in this whole novel, Moloch was in pursuit of the Word, the lost symbol, if you will. And so, in essence, Christianity had a lost symbol, or talks about having one, in the word logos, the Greek word. And likewise, other religions have it. It's in Hinduism. It's in Buddhism. And again, that's another way of him saying Christianity is no better. Certainly, if at all, it's on the same plane, the same level, in terms of conveying religious truth.
Next, Dan Brown writes about the spiritual vision of America's forefathers.
Solomon smiled. "My friends, don't get me wrong. Our forefathers were deeply religious men, but they were deists, men who believed in God, but in a universal and open-minded way. The only religious ideal they put forth was religious freedom." He pulled the microphone from the podium and strode out to the edge of the stage. "America's forefathers had a vision of a spiritually enlightened utopia in which freedom of thought, education of the masses, and scientific advancement would replace the darkness of outdated religious superstition."
Does Dan Brown have the vision of the forefathers right?
In part, he does. But when he talks about scientific advancement and knowledge, I'm not quite so sure that that was their thinking. At least, maybe it was with Benjamin Franklin, because he engaged in a lot of scientific experiments. But not relative to the others, that they wanted to found a country with spiritual and religious freedom. Or basically freedom. Yes, that was true. The American founding fathers, yes, and the quote that they were deists or deists, as the individual quoted in the excerpt, they were. Most of them were. Most of them were not what you could, or I would say, were Christians who would necessarily follow the Nicene Creed. They very much believed in Christian principles, but not necessarily in Christian doctrine. And that's a very key distinction that is often not made even by a lot of our evangelical Christian friends, who sometimes make our founding fathers, whether it's Washington or others, great exemplary Christians. Well, there are 20-some volumes of George Washington's writings, and only once, really, directly, does he mention the name of Jesus Christ. Ordinarily, he uses, heaven or the great the great leaders or something like that would never specifically mention Jesus Christ. And that was also very true of Benjamin Franklin. And as far as I can tell, it was true of many others. Now, there were some of our founding fathers that were Christians. But it's for the most part, they were influenced by the deistic philosophy, which arose in the 1700s, the 18th century in England. And these individuals, for the most part, were very well read. And so they were often influenced by the deistic philosophy, which in essence sought to reject Christian doctrine. But they did believe very strongly in Christian principles and morality. That has to be said. But it didn't necessarily, well, let's take a case for Jefferson, for example. Although he was not a Freemason, he was a free thinker. He was a deist. And in fact, there is a statement often made, the Jefferson Bible. He took literally a scissors and cut out all the miracles of the Gospels. He believed only in the moral teachings of the four Gospels. And so you have another example there of deism, the rationalistic philosophy that came about as a result of deism. And it rejected Christian doctrine, namely the doctrine of Trinity, the doctrine of virgin birth, and those fundamental doctrines that we as Christians hold dear.
As you mentioned before, Dan Brown also writes a lot about an important Masonic concept. He says it's called the Lost Word.
You think the Lost Word is buried in the cornerstone of the Washington Monument? I don't think, Robert. I know. The Lost Word was buried in the cornerstone of this monument on July 4th, 1848, in a full Masonic ritual. Langdon stared at him. Our Masonic forefathers buried a word? Peter nodded. They did indeed. They understood the true power of what they were burying. All night, Langdon had been trying to wrap his mind around sprawling ethereal concepts, the ancient mysteries, the lost word, the secrets of the ages. He wanted something solid, and despite Peter's claims that the key to it all was buried in a cornerstone 555 feet beneath him, Langdon was having a hard time accepting it. People study the mysteries for entire lifetimes and are still unable to access the power allegedly hidden there. Any answer, Langdon had always believed, was spread across the world in thousands of volumes, encoded into writings of Pythagoras, Hermes, Heraclitus, Paracelsus, and hundreds of others. The answer was found in dusty, forgotten tomes on alchemy, mysticism, magic, and philosophy. The answer was hidden in the ancient library of Alexandria, the clay tablets of Sumer, and the hieroglyphs of Egypt. "Peter, I'm sorry," Langdon said quietly, shaking his head. "To understand the ancient mysteries is a lifelong process. I can't imagine how the key could possibly rest within a single word." Peter placed a hand on Langdon's shoulder.
"Robert, the lost word is not a word."
He gave a sage smile. "We only call it the word because that's what the ancients called it, in the beginning."
Dr. Schmidt, what is Brown asserting here?
Boy, you know, that's one of the more loaded parts of the novel. For one, he's buying into the so-called Masonic conspiracy that critics have made, that they have buried the lost word or the lost symbol, as he would put it, at the title of his book. Well, of course, this is all speculation. Masonic literature has an awful lot on the lost word. You can check it, for example, in Mackey's Encyclopedia. You can check it in Coyle's Encyclopedia and numerous other articles, and I have read these over the years. And there is no solid agreement among Masons as to what the lost word actually consists of. It is a sort of a myth and allegory within Masonry itself, and it adds to the mysticism, to the, or the, if I may argue, the interest and maybe even excitement of Freemasonry. Did they bury that under the, see, when he's talking under 555 feet, he's talking about the Washington Monument, which is in an obelisk form, something that they borrowed, the founding fathers, from the Egyptians, which had kind of, if you will, occultic symbolism. And so did they bury the word? Well, I frankly would doubt it, because I don't think they've ever had it. It's always been a pursuit. in Masonic literature of finding this word. And then the question may arise, what is this word? Well, there's no real agreement on that. Basically, one can say it is basically to understand the mind of God and man's relationship to it. That's, I think you can say that without distorting it. But even most Masons are reluctant to put it that way. But if you read the gist and the context of the argument, basically what he's trying to say, and in essence, this is what Brown is driving at in his novel, too. And the individual by the name of Langdon is the guy whom he has in the novel. He is the Harvard expert in symbology.
Well, let's take a break there. I want you to pick up right there on the other side of the break with trying to sort out what Dan Brown is asserting in his fictional novel, the Lost Symbol, about the lost word of Masonry. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. live this Thursday afternoon, October the 15th. What kind of questions or comments do you have about Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol? 1-877-623-6943. 1-877-623-MYIE. Email us, talkback@issuesetc.org, or Twitter us at issuesetc. Our guest, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of Fraternal Organizations and co-author of the Encyclopedic Dictionary of Sects, Cults, and World Religions. Stay tuned.
The Lutheran Study Bible is the first time in the English language that the Lutheran Church has produced a study Bible to this extent.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Paul McCain, with his thoughts on the new Lutheran Study Bible.
It's entirely from scratch, as I say, using all original content. It will contain features that every Christian will love and cherish. It has what I think is the most important thing of all, a rich devotional quality to it that helps us understand when we are reading the Word of God, we are reading the mind of God and hearing His Word for us, and we respond to Him in pray, praise, and thanksgiving all through Jesus Christ our Lord. We are really excited about this Bible.
You can purchase the new Lutheran Study Bible by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, the Lutheran Study Bible.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Stephen Parks, on why your congregation should join the Issues Etc. 300.
If I could, I'd just like to challenge any Lutheran pastors that are listening to consider becoming one of the congregations that supports Issues Etc. My own congregation is a very small church, and I know it can be difficult to try and budget $1,000 a year to become one of the Issues Etc. 300. But if you're being blessed by this, as I know you are, and if your congregation is being blessed by this, as I know that it is, I submit to bring it to the congregation to prayerfully consider supporting the outreach of Issues Etc., not only here in the United States, but also around the world. Thank you so much for what you do.
Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your congregation's mission or advertising budget. Simply go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc., the Issues Etc. 300.
Some found it suspicious that the Great Seal of the United States had 13 stars, 13 arrows, 13 pyramid steps, 13 shield stripes, 13 olive leaves, 13 olives, 13 letters in Anuit Coeptis, 13 letters in E Pluribus Unum, and on and on.
An excerpt from Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol, wherein he asserts all sorts of connections between Freemasonry and American history and Christianity. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc., reviewing The Lost Symbol with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. A special thanks to Pastor Alan Lunnenberg of the Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word and all the members there. They've joined the Issues Etc. 300 in Rochester Hills, Michigan. Thanks to pastor and to congregation, the Issues Etc. 300 is a group of congregations, a growing group of congregations that have pledged to support Issues Etc. in their annual budget to the tune of $1,000 or more. We call them the Issues Etc. 300. They're the backbone of our support and our expansion. You can find out how your congregation can join the Issues Etc. 300 by going to our website, issues, etc.org. Click support, and you'll find a flyer that you can print off and take to your congregation when you ask them to join the Issues, Etc. 300, issues, etc.org. Click support. Dr. Schmidt, your reaction, if you would, to the assertion there that these Masonic symbols, and in this case, numbers, seem to have some connection to things very American, like the Great Seal of the United States.
Yes, the Great Seal of the United States, of course, is on the back of the dollar bill. In fact, the unfinished pyramid is there, which is mentioned many times, for example, in the novel. Now, and you, from the citation that you excerpted, it mentions a number of points, namely the 13 and so forth. Well, there are Masons that will deny that the symbol behind the dollar bill, on the back of the dollar bill, is Masonically influenced. There are also high-ranking Masons that say, yes, it is what is on there. And I have books and articles to on both sides of the argument. I personally believe that those who say it is influenced by or does convey Masonic symbolism is the correct way of looking at this. There's really a hard way of, you can really hardly get away from it. The symbol of the back of our $1 bill became part of it in 1935 under Franklin Delano Roosevelt's term of office, his first term. He was elected in 32, took office in 33. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a Freemason. His vice president at that time, Henry Wallace, was a Freemason. And they were instrumental in having it put on the back of the dollar bill. Previous to that, it was not on the dollar bill. Now, that in itself doesn't necessarily prove that it has Masonic symbolism. But there's even more than the excerpt of the book mentioned. If you look at the feathers of the wings of the eagle, the one has 32 feathers. The other one has 33 feathers, representing the Scottish Rite, which has 32 degrees, but the 33rd degree is an honorary degree. And the nine feathers in the tail, again, reflects back to the York Rite in terms of the 9 degrees, and the 10th degree is often given as the top of that, as sort of an honorary degree. So there's an awful lot of symbolism, including the unfinished pyramid. And on top of the unfinished pyramid is the all-seeing eye, a very prominent symbol of Freemasonry. Now, I must admit that all-seeing eye was in existence in some religious contexts, the like before Freemasonry was in existence. But nevertheless, you cannot read Freemasonry very much, very long, and not come across the all-seeing eye, which in essence represents the great or the grand architect, namely God.
Okay. One of the final assertions in the book near the very end, and it becomes rather overt, as you have said in your review of the book, has to do with ancient mysteries, as they're called by Dan Brown and his characters in The Lost Symbol, and the Bible.
Peter turned. Robert, don't you see? The ancient mysteries and the Bible are the same thing. Yes, exactly. You've put your finger on the precise problem. The moment mankind separated himself from God, the true meaning of the word was lost. The voices of the ancient masters have now been drowned out, lost in the chaotic din of self-proclaimed practitioners shouting that they alone understand the word, that the word is written in their language and none other. Peter continued down the stairs. Robert, you and I both know that the ancients would be horrified if they saw how their teachings have been perverted, how religion has established itself as a toll booth to heaven, how warriors march into battle believing God favors their cause. We've lost the word, and yet its true meaning is still within reach. Right before our eyes. It exists in all the enduring texts, from the Bible to the Bhagavad Gita to the Quran and beyond. All of these texts are revered upon the altars of Freemasonry because Masons understand what the world seems to have forgotten, that each of these texts, in its own way, is quietly whispering the exact same message. Peter's voice welled with emotion. Know ye not that ye are gods? Langdon was struck by the way this famous ancient saying kept surfacing tonight. He had reflected on it while talking to Galloway, and also at the Capitol building while trying to explain the apotheosis of Washington. Peter lowered his voice to a whisper. The Buddha said, "You are God yourself."
Dr. Schmidt, Is the teaching of the Bible, he mentioned there among other holy books that sit upon the altar of Freemasonry, is the central teaching of the Bible that we are gods ourselves?
Of course not. That's perhaps one of the biggest errors or perversions that he makes relative to religion. One of the things that is big, and this is what he's, I suppose, reacting against. He doesn't like the fact that Jesus Christ would say, as he did in John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by me. He is arguing that all of these religions, as we've mentioned a little bit before, have the truth, and Christianity basically has been, you know, an unfortunate group to say that it alone has the truth in the teachings of Jesus Christ. And, you know, when Peter said in his Pentecostal sermon, neither is there salvation in any other, for there's no name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. Again, you have the underscoring that religious truth is not found in other religions. And what's also interesting, he cites, for example, Buddha, he cites the Quran. As I often used to tell my students, all these different religions, if you put their books, lay them side by side, they contradict one another. Now, they cannot all be true if they contradict one another. And they could possibly all be wrong, but they can't all be true. Yet he picks up on this old deistic phrase or belief that all religions really are essentially equal in terms of they, you know, teach that God exists, but we never really know exactly who that God is, and Christians, unfortunately, have done too much defining in that regard. And that's his thrust again in this whole book. And also, thereby, it elevates and gives, you know, a lot of honor to Freemasonry, because they alone understood this, that there is no one religion, no one religious teaching that has all the truth. And this is, for example, as I mentioned before, they accept anybody as long as you believe in God, however you define him. And there's one other thing I might mention. In the average American lodge, an English-speaking lodge, you have an altar, and on top of the altar is a Bible. Now, if you go to a Muslim country, on top of that altar will be a Quran. If you go to a Buddhist country like Japan or China, maybe you'll have Confucius saying or Buddhist on top. But always on top, even on our Bible, lies the cross and the compass, which symbolizes it is more superior than the volume below it. And they refer to different books of the Bible or others, often abbreviated as VSL, very sacred. Finding the very sacred volume, I should have said. And so, again, it's sacred, but it isn't commensurate or equal to Christianity and the New Testament teaching that Christ is the only way of salvation.
All right, with only 15 seconds, is the book, The Lost Symbol, accurate historically, and is it reliable theologically? Only 15 seconds, Dr. Schmidt.
No, it's not accurately historically. As I said before, he mixes fact and fiction very frequently. And is it accurate theologically? By no means. In fact, I would say a Christian who reads this and is not very well informed will not have his faith edified, but probably weakened, because he or she doesn't really know the theology that is espoused here and how it contradicts the basic teachings of the New Testament.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of Fraternal Organizations and co-author of the Encyclopedic Dictionary of Cults, Sects, and World Religions. You can buy it through our website using the Amazon.com link. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on demand, and you'll find Dr. Alvin Schmidt and Encyclopedic Dictionary of Cults, Sects, and World Religions. Dr. Schmidt, thank you so much for being our guest.
My pleasure.
I know what you're going to say. You're going to say it's fiction. It's a novel. It's just a story. Well, read it, if you will, and with a critical eye, along with the other novels by Dan Brown, and you will find that he is not only telling, perhaps, page-turning stories full of action and intrigue and mystery, he also is asserting his own worldview. I would even go so far as to say his own religious viewpoint. And he is asserting it, undeniably, as true. He says all religions are the same. They all have the same message. Maybe he knows a lot about the Masonic Lodge, architecture of the Vatican, things like that. But he doesn't seem to know a lot about Christianity. or the Christ who claims to be the only way, the only truth, and the only life. And he's right. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.